As COVID-19 cases continue to rise, people in jails and prisons face a heightened danger of contracting the virus.
My main concern is for my brother, 50 years old and is diabetic, and if he was to contract COVID-19, he would probably lose his life.
I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina Vega on this Monday, March 30th. This is The Takeaway. Also on the show, we continue our new series, Joking from a Distance, with comedian Roy Wood Jr.
I don't really think that because the world is hurting, you shut down the labs, you just figure out the most tactful way to disseminate them. Because no matter what, there's still someone out there that this might help.
Let's get into it. As shelter in place and social distancing orders continue, we're doing our best to follow directions from the CDC to wash our hands, keep surfaces disinfected, and stay 6 feet away from each other. But in jails and prisons, that's a completely different story.
I've got a dear friend named Luther who has been sent to a private prison in Texas, which is pretty terrible. But now, because of the coronavirus, he's pretty nervous. I told him to try to stay away from people. Social distancing, that's impossible in a prison. And there's very little hand sanitizer or soap.
I have several concerns about the close proximity of all of the inmates that are locked up. I have loved ones that are there, and I'm not able to visit with them, and I haven't received mail in a little while. I do know they have confirmed cases of COVID-19 within the prison system. As a formerly incarcerated person, there is no such thing as social distancing. My main concern is for my brother. My brother is 50 years old and is diabetic, and if he was to contract COVID-19, he would probably lose his life. No one wants to lose a loved one to this disease.
Crowded conditions, a constant flow of correctional staff and incarcerated people in and out, and a lack of access to basic cleaning supplies and sanitizer make it difficult to avoid the virus. I myself have spent most of this pandemic looking into conditions in immigration jails in New York and New Jersey. Prison guards warn that a coronavirus outbreak in the correctional system could cause mass chaos for thousands of inmates across the country. At Rikers Island, New York City's main jail complex, over 100 inmates have already tested positive for the virus, and the rate of infection there is significantly higher than in the rest of the city and the rest of the country. I spoke with Kerry Blakinger, staff writer at the Marshall Project, and Keegan Hamilton, senior reporter at Vice News, on how inmates are being affected by the coronavirus outbreak. Kerry said that part of the reason incarcerated populations are at a higher risk for the coronavirus is that some of the basic disease prevention measures just don't work in prisons.
You're just housed on top of each other. There's a lot of dorm settings where you have so little personal space. During transports, you might be chained to the person next to you. And, you know, you don't have access to cleaning supplies. Even though a lot of facilities are saying that they're giving them out now, you know, we're still widely hearing reports of either watered down supplies or simply inadequate access to supplies or things are running out. Hand sanitizer is usually banned. You know, there's a lot of issues on that front. But in addition to that, incarcerated populations tend to have a higher rate of various medical issues. So a lot of these people are coming in at a higher risk to begin with.
Keegan, some jails, like in New Jersey, have made the decision to release some of the most vulnerable inmates, including the elderly and chronically ill, because of concerns over the coronavirus. Because of that, some communities are worried about the impact of these types of releases. What's your take on that?
I think that is a short-sighted concern on the part of people in these communities. You know, we're seeing the same thing at the federal level, where just recently the Attorney General announced a plan to try to release some inmates early to home confinement, people who are at risk of contracting the virus and have underlying health conditions. This problem, it doesn't just affect prisoners, it affects communities as well. The way that the virus is getting into these facilities more often than not is from the staff and correctional officers. And if it starts to spread and gets out of control in a prison facility or jail that is in the community, that virus is going to make its way back out into the public and affect everyone, not just people who are incarcerated and work at that prison facility.
And is the Bureau of Prisons doing anything specifically that they're saying is helping to slow the spread of the disease, or they hope is hoping to slow the spread of the disease? And have these any steps that they've taken been possibly effective yet?
So they have taken some measures. They, for one thing, they have halted all visits. That's both family visits and legal visits. Inmates are still allowed to make phone calls to their family members and to their attorneys, but those people are no longer being allowed into the prisons. They've also started screening new arrivals at the facilities, which, as I understand it, just means a temperature check and a form to see if they may have been exposed to the virus somewhere along their path to that prison. And guards are also now being required to undergo temperature checks and self-report any symptoms. Unfortunately, it seems like this is all too little too late and still not enough. Some of the guards who I've talked to say that, you know, they're being sent home with some, you know, some type of symptoms, maybe it's a runny nose or a cough. And then the headquarters in D.C. is telling them to come back the next day and clearing them without really asking them to isolate or doing a test. Because, you know, just like the rest of the country, the prison system doesn't have access to enough tests for the coronavirus to detect it and limit the spread that way.
It's interesting that they're not allowing visitors. Carrie, there's obviously public health benefits to restricting who's coming into the jail, but what are the inmates losing when they no longer have that connection to the outside world?
Well, for one, family connections are important in terms of reentry, and I think it harms people's chances of, you know, getting out and successfully reintegrating. And that's something we've talked about, you know, for a while, sort of broadly, the value of visits. But on top of that, they also lose a form of oversight, because some of the ways in which you report abuses are when someone shows up and you show them, like, I have a black eye, or, you know, whatever injuries you have or whatever problems you have to report that you maybe don't want to tell someone on a recorded phone line. So when people aren't coming into the facilities, when schools are canceled, there's no teachers coming in, when there's no media visits, when there's, you know, some oversight agencies are now not coming in for their site visits, and when you also lose family visits, you basically lose all forms of oversight, and these prisons are just going to be a black hole for the next few months.
And Carrie, you had spent some time in prison yourself, and your cellmate apparently is still in prison. Can you describe what it's like for her there right now?
Yeah, sure. I've been emailing with my cellmate from county jail, who is now in state prison. And, you know, it's been heartbreaking to watch her come to terms with some of the fears and realities that we're realizing here on the free world. And she's, you know, a few days behind this. Like, at first she was kind of like, oh, it's not going to affect me in here. And then when she realized it would, she started emailing me these questions. And there was this one email where her tone markedly changed, and it was all these questions about very basic things like, how does this spread, and is there a vaccine, are people working on it? And, you know, she was like, we just don't get these answers, and when we do, we don't trust them, which is valid. I mean, incarcerated people aren't going to trust the sources of information they have. And then, you know, as things have gone on, she's started telling me about the various social distancing measures that they've put in place, and, you know, the impacts that's had on her life in terms of, there's no school, there's no visits, they're going out to rec yard in shifts, they're making them sit like three seats apart in the mess hall, and all of these things are like good efforts to social distance that also, you know, can really make life more difficult for incarcerated people. And now she's dealing with, you know, something that I think a lot of us are dealing with, is worrying about, you know, elderly loved ones. She has a father who is 79 or 80, and, you know, she hasn't seen him in almost a decade. And, you know, she was like, I wonder how he's doing. And she's trying to get in touch, and she's worried about him and his health. And, you know, in prison, that's just a lot harder to deal with when you can't be there. So it's really sort of driving home how difficult this is, you know, for incarcerated people.
I'm speaking with Carrie Blakinger, staff writer at the Marshall Project, and Keegan Hamilton, senior reporter with Vice News, and we're talking about their coverage of the coronavirus and the impact on incarcerated populations. Keegan, you've reported on the Metropolitan Correctional Center in New York City, and not only are they still taking new prisoners, but they're holding people who have been charged but not convicted of crimes. What are some alternatives to that? I mean, is there a possibility that those people who are on pretrial detention can be let out given this situation?
That's exactly right. And that's the case at almost every jail in the United States, whether it's a federal jail or a local jail. These people are generally pretrial detainees who have not been convicted of any crimes. In the case of the federal jails in New York, there's one in Manhattan, the MCC, and one in Brooklyn, the MDC. And I'm told that both of those facilities are still taking in new prisoners, people who, you know, have in some cases have been charged and are being asked to self-surrender, to turn themselves in, are asked to come into the jail. That's a risk of bringing in the virus that they've contracted in the community in New York. And the guards who have talked to the facilities are just baffled as to why this person who in some cases has been home for months is being asked to suddenly come in at this point in time to turn themselves in. In fact, the inmate at the MDC in Brooklyn who tested positive for COVID-19 was somebody who was a new inmate who was just booked in recently within the past couple weeks or so, and brought the virus in with them and potentially contaminated multiple areas of the jail. And last count, they had something like 80 to 90 people who may have been exposed in isolation. Some of those people were symptomatic.
You said may have been exposed. And Carrie, I'm just wondering how hard it is to get information out of these jails and prisons. What are some of the issues with transparency in the prison system that could maybe make this virus more difficult to track as the pandemic unfolds?
Well, I think so many prison systems in different states simply do not respond to information requests that they don't want to answer. I asked New York State for a number of days if inmates were going to be allowed to use hand sanitizer now that they were, you know, forced to be making it. And I got no response for many days. They simply ignored the question. But, you know, I often have situations where prison officials are lying to me, and I know they're lying because sometimes I get documentation, sometimes I just have enough officer reports. And when you have these agencies that have a track record of dishonesty, you know, it really raises concerns about if we're ever really going to know what happens during all of this and what medical care people are or are not offered and what measures they're actually implementing in the way that they say they are.
Carrie Blakinger is a staff writer at the Marshall Project, and Keegan Hamilton is a senior reporter with Vice News. Thank you both for your reporting and for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
As the number of COVID-19 cases rises in hospitals across the U.S., many states have started calling for all non-urgent and elective procedures to be delayed.
For example, if you had scheduled to have a knee replacement or a hip replacement, that is an absolutely important procedure to have. It will hopefully really help improve someone's quality of life, maybe really decrease the amount of pain they have and increase their functionality. But it's something where right now is just not the right time to have those procedures, given the other constraints on the healthcare system.
That's Dr. Alyssa Burghardt. She's a bioethicist at the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics.
The goal is to conserve the personal protective equipment, the ICU beds, the ventilators, all the things that we need to take care of critically ill patients, not just with COVID-19, but also the patients who will continue to have severe illnesses that need treatment.
The takeaway is Duarte Geraldino spoke with Dr. Burghardt a couple of days ago. To start, he asked her how we're defining essential care in this moment.
The terminology can be very frustrating and difficult for people because, of course, if you've planned your entire life around having a surgery, you've arranged to have time off work. Maybe it's a surgery for a child and you've arranged it over their vacation. Of course, it absolutely is essential to you. What the American College of Surgeons has done, however, is given a tiering system to really help guide surgeons, patients, anesthesiologists, other caregivers to help determine what is a procedure that is essential today or essential in the immediate time period around this pandemic versus what are procedures that can safely wait for weeks to months to be rescheduled.
How much does the safety of patients themselves factor into postponing these procedures?
I think that patients are our number one concern when we're making these decisions. You know, I had a case on my schedule recently where there were specific reasons to that patient that having that procedure was very important and made it much more urgent than it would have been for another patient. And so I think we really want to make sure that our patients are safe, that they're able to get urgent care as quickly as possible, understanding that there are additional risks to coming to the hospital right now that we would like to be able to avoid for as many patients as we can in a safe way.
And who exactly is making the decision about what can be delayed or canceled? Are we talking about state government, hospital administrators, or surgeons themselves?
I think this is a changing environment. And I think, on March 17th, when the American College of Surgeons made their recommendation, they were really thinking about surgeons with their patients making these decisions. And that's absolutely where the first part of this conversation needs to happen, is between the patient and a physician who knows them well, who knows the context of their disease. Different hospitals are dealing with where to go from there differently. I think leaving it solely to surgeons to decide if and when to cancel their surgeries, that's not going to work for everyone. There are going to be surgeons who have different conflicts of interest. Surgeons care very deeply about their patients and may struggle to cancel certain cases, even if they are ones that could wait. There's also a lot of financial difficulties that hospitals and surgeons and anesthesiologists and everyone who is supported by the perioperative environment can experience. So many hospitals are using a little bit more of a collaborative approach, where that initial conversation is between the surgeon and their patient, but there's usually some sort of a process that can help to deal with disagreements. Or if a surgeon feels really strongly like, listen, I know that this might sound like this is a non-essential procedure, but I feel really strongly because of X, Y, and Z. And if there's a significant disagreement there, having a system where that can go up to somebody else who can help resolve that issue.
Some hospitals are still doing procedures that are considered non-essential or elective. What are some of the reasons that they're moving forward with these procedures?
Certain reasons that a hospital might move forward with elective cases or non-essential surgery is that there may actually be patient-specific factors that make that an important procedure to do today, and only the patient and their physician will know that. There's other hospitals that truly are struggling with the fact that they have low incidence of COVID-19 in their community right now, and they're dealing with really significant financial implications where they're worried they might not be able to keep the lights on. Hospitals work on a very narrow margin. Even the best funded hospitals do not work with a significant amount of margin. And so for many hospitals, like rural hospitals, very small hospitals, sometimes greater than 60% of their funding comes through these outpatient surgeries. And so that the financial concerns are huge, and they're absolutely important. Obviously, we've seen significant damage to our economy already due to the pandemic, and hospitals are part of that.
We're also seeing some states like Ohio and Texas classify procedures like abortion as non-essential. What do you make of this move? Are abortions being misclassified as non-essential healthcare?
I would argue that abortions are being misclassified. I think it's an incredibly opportunistic move by people who have very strong feelings about abortion. And unfortunately, if you need to have an abortion, that's a very time-limited procedure. And many states have significant time limitations on when an abortion is going to be possible. They're safer for women earlier in a pregnancy. And so if you make someone wait 4 weeks, 8 weeks before they can have their procedure, or even have access to medication, which might be an easier time earlier in a pregnancy, then you're really disproportionately affecting the lives of women who are already going to be hit very hard economically, emotionally, and health-wise during this pandemic.
Are there any other types of procedures which you believe are also being politicized in this moment?
I think one of the things that I worry about is the care of people who have disabilities and the care of people who are in other marginalized groups, such as transgender patients. I know that there's procedures, for example, that transgender patients will be life-changing and may really significantly improve their mental health, may decrease their chance of suicide. What's difficult is that in the middle of this pandemic, those cases are being delayed, and I think that it's very understandable, and I think right now it's the right thing to do. But oftentimes patients with transgender needs or just gender care in general have their care delayed over and over and over again. And so I do worry about how significantly those cases in particular might be delayed given the fact that they are politicized.
Dr. Alyssa Burgard is a bioethicist at the Stanford Center for Biomedical Ethics.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Over the past month, we've seen travel bans, enforced social distancing, and a slump in the global economy due to COVID-19. But this has had a surprising side effect. It has led to a significant drop in greenhouse gas emissions. So that begs the question, is the coronavirus pandemic bringing unintended climate benefits, or is the dip in emissions basically inconsequential in the long run? Thousands are suffering from the crisis. People are getting sick and losing their jobs. Yet many of the most vulnerable to the effects of this crisis live in communities that may soon face climate-related natural disasters, like floods, hurricanes, and fires. Families may have to decide whether to hunker down and stay in place to avoid being infected or to evacuate their homes. To understand the intersection between climate change and the coronavirus, The Takeaway's Duarte Geraldino recently spoke with Brad Plumer, climate reporter with the New York Times. Brad began by explaining whether the recent drop in emissions could have a long-term positive effect on the environment.
So in general, with climate change, if we're talking about a short-term dip that's likely to rebound, which is, I think, what we're probably seeing here, it doesn't have a huge impact on climate change. What matters over the long run is, you know, long-term emissions and how we're actually powering our economy. And, you know, I think on the flip side, if we're looking at a huge economic slowdown, quite possibly a very severe recession, you know, one factor to consider is that concern about the environment and climate change often tends to fade during these moments. So that will be a big thing to watch going forward.
So in the rush to help people make ends meet, the environment may lose out given future policies that we don't know of just yet. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, it really depends on how policymakers react to this crisis. So one possibility is, as the head of the International Energy Agency, Fatih Birol, recommended, he said, look, as countries are trying to stimulate their economies back to health and get out of this recession, it's a great opportunity right now to invest in clean energy and accelerate the transition to a low carbon future. But we don't know if governments and policymakers are actually going to take that advice. You can look at places like China, where in the past, when they've suffered big economic slowdowns, what they've done to stimulate their economy is try to pump money into heavy industry, steel, cement, which actually causes emissions to rise even faster. You see calls in some areas to relax pollution controls and environmental regulations in order to bring the economy back to health. So a lot really depends on how policymakers react to this economic crisis. And this could be a turning point for clean energy emissions, but it also, we could very well see the world backslide in some ways.
Brett, we've seen the oil price go down. Doesn't that mean that people will be using more fossil fuels? Isn't that bad for the climate?
So generally, that's the relationship, right? When oil's cheap, people use a lot of it, emissions go up. Right now, everything is so uncertain because no one's traveling. It's not like people are going to take advantage of cheap gasoline, cheap airfare to go travel the world and take more vacations. They're staying at home. It's really a weird time that we've never really seen a situation quite like this before. And it's not at all clear that the cheap oil will actually lead to higher demand.
That was Brad Plumer, climate reporter from the New York Times. None of us know exactly for how long the coronavirus will continue to affect lives around the globe, but it may be at least a few months. Duarte Geraldino recently spoke with David Wallace Wells, deputy editor and climate columnist for New York Magazine, about what this all means.
Well, we're already entering into the season where we're likely to see a fair amount of flooding through the Midwest, as we saw last year, at a level that really devastated the whole American farming community. In about 6 weeks is the start of hurricane season, so that could be threatening as well. And then following that comes the wildfire season in the West. And, you know, firefighters use the same basic N95 masks that we've been seeing such shortages of across the country. And exactly how we balance those two interests this fire season will be quite complicated at a policy level, at a social level. In general, I think the dynamics are exactly as you outlined in the intro, which is to say, for the time being, many millions of Americans are, if not outright restricted to their homes, then basically being encouraged very aggressively to stay in them as much as possible. And natural disasters are a real threat to those bunkers, so to speak. And we don't really have any kind of policy response that I know of or policy plan in place that would sort of suggest an alternate path. Like, how do we, if a tornado is bearing down on your community, how do you balance that, the need to protect yourself versus the need to protect yourself from contagion? We don't have those plans in place, in part because we're in unprecedented times, but I think it's in part also a failure of federal, state, and local community planning that we haven't yet sorted these things through. On the other hand, of course, this whole saga is moving incredibly quickly, putting intense pressures on us that we didn't imagine were possible just a few months ago. And we're going to be having to be doing a lot of this by the seat of our pants as we're doing all of the epidemiological and public health measures as well.
David, I read your book, and one of the things I was struck by was the idea that climate change could actually unleash other illnesses, other diseases. Now, we know so far that COVID-19 wasn't directly caused by climate change, but what kind of diseases are we likely to see more of as temperatures rise?
There's a huge category of public health issues arising from climate change. I actually think the most dramatic one is not disease. It's from air pollution that comes from the burning of fossil fuels, which today is, according to The Lancet, the British scientific journal, killing already 9 million people a year globally. But there are, of course, disease impacts as well. The ones that I think of as sort of most obvious are those diseases that are carried by mosquitoes. They're tropical diseases that used to be mostly restricted to the tropics. And if you were living in New York or Stockholm, you didn't have to worry about malaria or dengue. Within a few decades, we expect that mosquitoes will be traveling much further north, perhaps even as far north as Northern Europe and the Arctic Circle, which means that many of those diseases will be carried to some extent there as well. That's not to say that these metropolises are going to be totally pulled under by those diseases, but it will be a public health factor in the life of those cities and those communities in a way that it never was before. And this is especially interesting to me because, you know, for centuries now, the nations of Western Europe and the U.S. have sort of, you know, looked down on the nations of the equatorial regions of the world as sort of hotbeds of disease and pestilence. But of course, climate change, which is mostly a product of what we've done in the West, will be coming to greet us in the relatively near future. But in general, when you have destruction of ecosystems and destabilizing natural habitats, diseases flourish and travel. And climate change is accelerating all of those changes, all those transformations, which means it's not so easy to predict. We can't just say, okay, these diseases that are in the tropics today will be in the mid-regions in 15 years and in the Arctic in 40 years or whatever. It's also the case that we're going to encounter many diseases we've never seen before that were relatively restrained or quarantined in particular regions of the world and which will begin to travel in the decades ahead.
What do you think the role of alarmism has played in this crisis, and what can we learn from what's happening with climate change?
You know, my feeling is that this one of the lessons of this story is very clearly that we should, generally speaking, trust and respect alarmism more than we do. In late January, a Harvard epidemiologist named Eric Feigl-Ding posted a Twitter thread that was really hair-raising in its fear-mongering about coronavirus and produced a pretty significant backlash among his colleagues and among public health officials and even journalists for being sort of out over his skis about the data. And, you know, the things that he was saying haven't come precisely to pass. But I think looking back on it now, it seems at least clear to me that if the entire world had been alarmed as he was, and if all of our leaders had been alarmed about this disease as he was, we'd be in a much, much better position now than we are. And I think we have a kind of a bias, generally speaking, a cultural bias, which has a lot of roots and, you know, draws on a lot of psychological reflexes, but I think also goes back to the sort of large shadow of the British experience during the Blitz of keep calm and carry on, where we basically think that the most responsible way to respond to any crisis is carefully, cautiously, and calmly. And I don't want my leaders to be running around screaming through the halls. I want them to be making strategic plans, of course, but I also want them to be planning for unlikely but quite terrifying scenarios, and making sure that we are as prepared for them as we possibly can be. And sometimes that means moving quite quickly and aggressively to take action against a new threat, even before we know for sure that it will deliver its full force against us, still taking precautions as though it will, so that if it does, we will have the resources we need. What we've done in this case instead, in the U.S. in particular, but really in almost all countries across the West, with the possible exception of Germany, we've basically waited until the virus was like staring us in the face, killing people, you know, in our cities and sending many hundreds, if not thousands, into our hospitals before we really even started taking seriously the problem of taking public health or the need to take public health measures against it. And I think that we know this time it's far too late. And with climate change, the dynamic is the same. The longer we wait, the harder it'll be to take the measures that we need to take to ensure a relatively livable, relatively prosperous, relatively just future for us all in the face of global warming.
David Wallace Wells is deputy editor and climate columnist for New York Magazine. It's The Takeaway. I'm Matt Katz, in for Tanzina Vega, and coming to you today from our studio, well, my tiny bedroom closet in Philadelphia, while my kids are isolated in front of the TV. Staying home with kids during the coronavirus outbreak is presenting a unique set of challenges for parents across the country. Last week, comedian Roy Wood Jr. was grilled on this experience by his three-year-old son.
Are you the daddy?
I mean, you know, we're in unprecedented times right now, and I really think that fatherhood is a moving target, and I don't think it's fair to say that you could be a good dad or a bad dad when the truth of the matter is that, you know, fatherhood, the best you can be is trying to be a good father every day. This quarantine is stressing everybody. You know, you're spending more time around your kids. I'm lucky because all I got is a three-year-old. If he was 14, 15, I'd have to fight him every day. But I got a three-year-old. You just give him chocolate milk and graham crackers, and you're pretty much in the game for most of the day. So we'll just look at the tape and see what we can do tomorrow to be a better parent.
Roy is a stand-up comic and a correspondent for The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. So far, his day job has remained relatively steady. He's still working on segments for The Daily Show from home. But the widespread economic toll of social distancing has Roy worried about the future of comedy clubs across the country. In our series, Joking from a Distance, we're checking in with comedians during the coronavirus outbreak. I spoke with Roy about what this moment means for the stand-up world.
You know, there are a lot of comedy clubs that are closing. A lot of them have started GoFundMes for the staff. Comedian Mike Birbiglia quarterbacked something that, you know, I've been helping him with called tipyourwaitstaff.com. And basically, Birbiglia and I are getting on the internet and having, you know, candid conversations with stand-ups just about their joke writing process. And we're doing it. Each comedian nominates a comedy club and we raise money for their waitstaff. End of the week, we send that money down to the club, make sure that the staff gets a little something to keep them afloat. Because even with the federal assistance that's coming down the pipe, that's not going to be enough, especially when you think about how comedy and entertainment will be one of the last things to come back, as it should be, because it's a disposable income expenditure. So, you know, when we think about those people that have, you know, thrived in these comedy clubs for so long, you know, we just wanted to be able to do something for them. The comedians, on the other hand, that's a totally different conversation. You know, I'm not sure what we'll be able to do down the road for the actual comedians, but I think ultimately what will happen is that, you know, comedians are going to have to start figuring out their own venues and creating more independent spots. I think the alt comedy movement that started in the early aughts, kind of that first generation, Brian Posehn, Sarah Silverman, Patton Oswalt, I think their style of finding atypical venues to do comedy in, I think that's going to become the new norm. You know, I could be wrong. You know, it's all too early to tell. I just know that a lot of clubs are going to close and not come back, period. So off of that alone, there are fewer places for comedians in those areas to do comedy. So if you're a person who wants to do comedy, you now either have to move to a coast or figure out your own infrastructure. And if you're currently a road comic that tours 50 weeks a year, you're probably only going to tour 40. If you're someone that only tours 40, you're probably only going to do 25. You do 25, you're only going to do 10. Like, so there's going to be adjustments. You know, it just remains to be seen just how far these are going to go.
Yeah. In the meantime, you said you were raising money for some of these comedy club workers, and you've been using Instagram Live. And I'm just curious what it's like telling jokes and making people laugh without actually hearing an audience other than maybe a three-year-old. I mean, you see the little stuff, the little hearts come up on Instagram, but you don't hear anything. Is that just bizarre? How do you work off that?
It's different for me. It's a medium that a lot of other comedians swim in. There's an adjustment, but, you know, people are responding. So you know that it's not falling on deaf ears. But there are people that are doing true stand-up comedy, microphone and the whole nine, just into a camera and uploading that online. There's people that are doing comedy in their room and streaming it on YouTube. Like, there are a million and one different things. There are a million and one different ways to do it. Comedian Mark Norman, he did something the other day where he went out in the street and performed comedy to people one by one while maintaining social distance. So it was kind of like Man on the Street, kind of like Billy Eichner, but it was just one guy with a microphone, and, you know, he's got rubber gloves on. Like, it was very creative. It was very creatively well done.
And you're still doing the Daily Show. I wanted to play a clip from that. One assignment you had this month was evaluating some of the disaster movies that people have been talking about during the coronavirus outbreak. Here's what you had to say about the movie Contagion.
So Contagion, Gwyneth Paltrow spreads a pandemic all over the world. It's kind of like Goop, but without the steaming. But the cast is stacked. You had Gwyneth, you had the white girl from Titanic that let Leo DiCaprio die. You had Walter White, Matt Damon. I'm not sure if he was talking in a Boston accent in that movie. The virus is spreading wicked fast. Overall, if you're worried about catching that Rona, watch another movie other than Contagion. It is too close to home.
I'm laughing here in my closet. Are you just, you guys at the Daily Show, I mean, is it all Corona all the time? I mean, is that when you're emailing back and forth and coming up with segments? I mean, are you trying to make people laugh about this thing but not cross the line? And is this the only thing you guys are talking about?
We are here to educate and inform, and if there's a joke that can be done tastefully, then, you know, we'll take that opportunity. But I think when it's a time of tragedy, the joke is never about the tragedy. The joke is about it being mishandled, the people mishandling it, or things that are happening in the surrounding orbit of the tragedy. Okay, Corona's the issue, and people are dying, and some people are not heeding the warnings. Okay, fine. But then you look at the airline industry eliminating middle seats. How are people adjusting to this tragedy? There's jokes in that. The ridiculousness that the airline industry deserves another bailout. You know, when you look at some of the things that certain cities are doing, like all of the mayors in Italy, like all of our politicians are composed on television, and, you know, Governor Cuomo and Governor Newsom in California, please, people, do the right thing, and da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da. Meanwhile, Italian mayors on TV literally cursing out the town. It looks like two rappers beefing with each other. That's funny. Yeah. That contrast is funny. And in nowhere in there have you stepped on the severity of what's going on in the reality of this world. This video of Italian helicopters pulling up to people on the beach and letting the rotor wash sweep sand into people's eyes to shoo them off of the beach. That's funny.
I didn't see that.
Go find that. That's very funny. But you're not making jokes about people dying. You're not making jokes about the hospitals being overstaffed and stressed out. So there's always going to be jokes on the outer orbit, on the outer rings of an issue that you can kind of find and then settle into something more serious. You know, I don't really think that because the world is hurting, you shut down the laughs. You just figure out the most tactful way to disseminate them, because no matter what, people still, there's still someone out there that this might help, and they might find this funny, and it gets them through just to the next day.
Roy Wood Jr. is a stand-up comedian and correspondent for The Daily Show with Trevor Noah. Thanks so much for making us laugh, Roy.
Thank you.
Okay, folks, that's a Monday takeaway in the books. Special shout out to board operator Claire McKean and sound engineer and director Vince Fairchild, who are at our studio in New York City today making it all happen while the rest of our team, including myself, work from home. And today is National Doctors' Day, so we also want to take a moment to recognize everyone working in healthcare during this crisis. Thank you. Also, if you missed anything or want to listen back again, check out our podcast. It's on thetakeaway.org, iTunes, Spotify, anywhere you get your podcasts. If you like it, subscribe, rate us. And of course, call us about anything, 877-8-MY-TAKE, or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Matt Katz, in this week for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.